Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. One of our commitments here on Ask Dr. Dawn is to keep you abreast of useful research related to Alzheimer's disease. There's a lot of research out there, a lot of it done on mice that are bred to develop Alzheimer's, nothing really close to what humans have because they've mutated the protein to get it to agglomerate in order to imitate Alzheimer's, which is great but for drug testing, but unfortunately, none of the drugs that they've developed using this mouse model have actually done much good in humans. Because we don't have a mutated protein, per se, that's premature Alzheimer's. Most of the Alzheimer's disease burden are people who have the normal Alzheimer's version of beta amyloid, but for some not well understood reason, it aggregates and causes nerve loss. In this particular story, we're talking about apathy, which is one of the early symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, which is really disabling. Similar to depression, people with apathy just don't want to do anything. They don't want to engage, and they have no interest in maintaining their hygiene or their household and are therefore, well, disabled, if you will. And at an earlier age, with more cognitive ability than might be the case in other Alzheimer's patients. So these are people who are quite salvageable. In a 12-week trial, investigators randomized 60 community-dwelling male U.S. veterans. The average age was 77, and they all had apathy and mild Alzheimer's disease. Half the group was given 10 milligrams of methylphenidate. That's Ritalin, a drug used for attention deficit disorder. A lot of these men had hypertension, about 85%, and almost 50% had coronary artery disease. So giving something that's a stimulant was a concern in the study. Well, first the good news. There were significant improvements for the methylphenidate group at 4 weeks for their apathy scores. At 8 weeks, their behavior, thinking, and motivation had improved, and at 12 weeks, their depression had improved. So, yeah, pretty good. Two thumbs up on the low-dose Ritalin. Also important, there were no significant increases in adverse events. Now, this was only a 12-week trial, but significantly, blood pressure remained stable, and they didn't trigger any heart attacks. Needs to be replicated in a larger group, but very important improvements in functionality in Alzheimer's patients need to be taken seriously. Furthermore, methylphenidate is available as an inexpensive generic, and this is a relatively low dose. I looked it up. You can get the stuff for $30 for 90 pills at Costco. Other pharmacies are charging $100, but if you use one of the coupon services like GoodRx, you can get it for about the $30 price tag. Why am I telling you this? Well, because it would be an off-label indication. Therefore, your Medicare Part D is not going to cover this, most likely, without somebody doing major handstands. And even then, it's difficult to imagine that it will go easily. Medicare covers things for their FDA indication, and this is definitely, as we say in the trade, off-label. That being said, a dollar a day to get Dad back online and functioning would mean a lot to caretakers and people who are living with individuals with early Alzheimer's. Improving engagement, reducing apathy, and even improving cognition with a cheap generic drug sounds like a plan to me. This next study, although it was done on those pesky Alzheimer's mutant mice, still, I think, is useful in terms of the information it provides and the direction for future research. For many, many years, the assumption has been that the problem with Alzheimer's is the amyloid beta plaques. And in recent years, there's been a slight rethinking of this to say, well, maybe it's not just the plaques, but it's the plaques plus inflammation that lead to the loss of nerve cells and the cognitive defects that we know as Alzheimer's disease. Well, that research that I'm about to talk about further supports the idea that inflammation is really the critical piece. The researchers counted the numbers of a particular type of immune cell known as microglia in samples in the brains of both individuals with Alzheimer's and those without who were of the same age. Obviously, these were autopsy specimens. These were human beings. They also measured the activity of the molecules that regulate the numbers of microglia, and they found that that correlated with the severity of the Alzheimer's disease. First of all, it's amazing to me that we're at the level of looking at control molecules, and I love this brave new world in which I find myself. So the researchers thought, let's look at microglia in mice who have been bred to develop Alzheimer's, those pesky mutant mice again. They wanted to find out whether blocking the receptor that's responsible for regulating microglia, a structure known as CSF1R, would change the progression of Alzheimer's in the mice. So they gave the mice oral doses of an inhibitor that blocks this receptor and found that it could prevent the rise in microglia numbers seen in untreated mice as the disease progressed. Well, it worked, Orville. Not only did they improve the rise in microglia, preventing that in the treated mice, but the inhibitor also prevented the loss of communication points, the synapses, between the nerve cells in the brain, also associated with Alzheimer's. And the treated mice demonstrated fewer memory and behavioral problems compared with the non-treated group. Really important, the team found that the drug they used blocking this CSF1R did not impair the number of microglia necessary to maintain a normal immune function. It just prevented that number from rising above that threshold. This is analogous to what we see when we use curcumin to block the COX, cyclooxygenase enzyme, in humans. Actually, the curcumin and the fish oil both block it in different ways, but curcumin blocks it at the level of the DNA, so you don't make more of the COX enzyme. Ibuprofen, on the other hand, blocks COX at the far side, so you block it at the very last thing that it does, rather than preventing it from coming into existence in the first place. When you block something totally, however, you probably screw up physiology. So discovering that the number of microglia that were necessary at baseline in an uninflamed brain did not drop is really important here. So the mice did well, and the CSF1R protein is now clearly identified as a potential drug target in humans. Of course, the researchers are happy to collaborate with industry and produce and test drugs that might work in human beings. And in the meantime, while all of that's happening, may I suggest that we move towards, in our own lives, using anti-inflammatory compounds like curcumin, omega-3 fatty acids, green tea extract, and other potent anti-inflammatories that do penetrate the brain to see if we can do a mini version of targeting the microglia upregulation that's implicated in Alzheimer's by this work with agents which are widely available and food-based, which, for my money, if it's a molecule that existed on the planet before the first monkey, then it's probably something my body can handle. Let's take a break from all of the science for the moment. And, well, we never take a break from science here, but at least the deep dive in the research, and answer some emails. So before I do that, I want to remind you, you can always send me an email. You can go to my website at askdrdawn.com and send me a question. Sometimes these go out on one of my live shows, sometimes on a show that's pre-recorded. So I can never really guarantee a time. Also, want to remind you, I don't necessarily use everyone's question. But in the case of this one from Ray in San Francisco, I initially backed Bernadette. And then I thought to myself, you know, actually, this is a good intro to give people some tools and some power in terms of navigating this mess, which is research and the news and everything else. And if there's anything we need right now, it's to take it into our own hands to verify and understand how to use and gain new information and vet it for that matter. So here's what I suggest. In the case of Ray's question, stinging nettles, please explain the toxicities, if any, of stinging nettle root supplements in post-transplant patients. Well, it depends upon your drugs. But let's see how I would start out approaching this question if I knew what the drugs were. Details, people, details. First of all, I would look up stinging nettles and I would discover which, if any, enzymes were known to be inhibited by the stinging nettle root. A search in scholar.google.com for cytochrome P450 and stinging nettle root turned up a number of studies, all of which were reassuring with respect to any identified problem with stinging nettle root interfering with the breakdown or activation of drugs, which is what this cytochrome P450 system does. Now, I want to point out that there are lots of other ways that herbs can interfere with drugs, including changing the absorption from the intestine, as occurs in certain situations with other herbs, interfering with breakdown in other ways. But if you search for this, you're likely going to turn up all of these other interactions, because honestly, there's a lot of money from Big Pharma in discrediting herbs. And so if you want to do that research, somebody's going to fund your trial. Okay, back to the science. So let's suppose at this point that I have determined, contrary to this example, that in fact there is an issue with, let's say, cytochrome 2D6. Well, in that case, you will then want to search your drug for information about whether it is, in fact, metabolized through this pathway. If you discover that that is the primary pathway for metabolism, you then have to discover whether or not it's activation or whether or not it's competition. And it gets complicated at this point, so I welcome you to go this far, and then shoot me an email if you get lost. But the point I want to make here is that a lot of this, an enormous amount of this, is being studied all the time. And the information, unlike years ago when I was growing up and becoming a baby doctor, it's right there. Just type in the words and go scooting around the literature. All of the computer-based search engines, well, they're like the dog that wants to bring you your slippers. They're eager to serve. And it's a matter of educating yourself about how to use them. And honestly, in this age of information overload and deceit, every single one of us needs to develop search skills that allow us to verify, validate, and explore all the information that is out there on the web. It's your civic responsibility, literally. This next email is from Emily in Santa Cruz. Subject, feeling faint while flying. Dear Dr. Dawn, thank you for your podcast. I enjoy it very much. My question is regarding feeling faint while flying. I've had several near syncopal episodes while on long overnight flights. Near syncopal means almost fainting, for those of you who don't recognize the word. Most recently, I was asleep on a flight, and the feeling woke me up. Drenched in sweat, nauseous, etc., and it took what felt like several minutes of toe-tapping and leg movement to recover. I was stuck in a window seat and was not able to lie down. I didn't want to bother anyone, figuring the feeling would go away. Do you have any idea why this happens and how I might prevent it in the future? I've heard of people fainting when standing up suddenly, but this wasn't the case. It has occurred for me several times, but on overnight flights only. I'm 35, by the way. Not sure it makes a difference, and I've never passed out in everyday life. Thanks so much. So, detectives, what do we know about Emily? We know she's 35 and she's female, so she's probably not using hormone replacement therapy, but she might be on birth control. We know that she doesn't faint and probably doesn't have low blood pressure under ordinary circumstances, but on long overnight flights, in coach, I'm assuming, she's got this problem, and it's happened several times. So what are your hypotheses? Well, in Emily's case, I came up with two right off the top. The first one is hypoxia-induced arrhythmia. That means that she's sleeping sitting up, her head's probably down, she may not be taking deep breaths, and she's at 8,000 feet in terms of the oxygen partial pressure in that environment. So she may be experiencing a kind of sleep apnea that only happens to her when she's flying. This could be leading to a heart arrhythmia, and she could be waking up drenched in sweat and nauseous because of the adrenaline that's being generated by her body to try and get her to breathe. So that's a possibility. She doesn't mention numbness, but then she says something about toe tapping and leg movement. So I'm not sure if her legs felt numb. But if they didn't, then this hypothesis is certainly in the running. The second thing that comes to mind is blood pooling and dehydration. On long flights, particularly if you're stuck in the window seat, you may opt not to drink much water so you don't have to climb over two people to get to the bathroom. But because of the low air pressure and the fact that your legs are down, your blood may pool and you may become quite dehydrated. In that circumstance, your blood pressure will drop, and that will also cause sweat and nausea. So what do this have in common? The two things have in common sympathetic outflow. We're not going to solve Emily's problem here, but in terms of advice, one of the things that I would recommend is that you hydrate and take a deep breath and annoy the people next to you. Stay hydrated. Eat a lot of salt before you get on the flight, even if you're not a salt eater. And yes, you will bloat and have some swelling in your legs. On the subject of swelling in your legs, support hose, very, very important. You can buy airplane socks or, my recommendation, over-the-knee, thigh-high support hose, which, thanks to all of those trans people out there, God bless you. These are available in all sizes. So get yourself some thigh-high, strong support hose and keep the blood in the central circulation when you fly. With respect to the hydration, no caffeine for 24 hours before you fly. Now, this is for people who are not doing well. If you do just fine on your flights, well, go for it. But for people who are having issues, staying away from caffeine and hydrating the heck out of yourself before you get on that airplane is a darn good idea. Our next email is from Sam in Missouri. Sam writes, vegan alternative to fish oil. Could you comment on using algal oil as a vegan alternative to fish oil? Well, Sam, before I do that, I first of all just want to say that I think the Sermon on the Mount was incomplete, because there should have been a line in there about blessed are the vegans, for they shall economically support the development of a food system not based on animal protein that will sustain humanity into the next century. That being said, to get to your issue, algal oil is primarily DHA. This form of omega-3 is a very acceptable alternative to fish oil. It's more expensive, but again, God bless the vegans for their economic support of the food system. And what it will do as far as your inflammatory markers, which is the primary reason that I advocate the use of fish oil, is it will do a very good job of making your prostaglandins the kinder, gentler prostaglandins that are less inflammatory, the kind that were on the planet back when we were hunter-gatherers, which is what this is all about. It's all about trying to replicate the diet that we were evolved to eat rather than the diet that it has been convenient for our industrial food chain to offer us. The problem with that diet, while it is cheap and abundant and eliminates hunger, is that it has some innate toxicities that need to be addressed and acknowledged. Well, anyway, Sam, hope you liked this answer. And finally, this email from Wendy in San Diego. Subject: vaccines. Dear Dr. Don, I'm interested in your opinion about vaccine safety in children. I'm a mother to a healthy one-year-old, and I faced a lot of resistance from family members in wanting to vaccinate her. There is fear among parents that vaccines poison children and cause autism, despite the Wakefield experiment being retracted and falsified. As a compromise, we have done an alternative vaccine schedule where she received less vaccines than recommended by the CDC. I've researched the science on both sides, and it is confusing to know what the right choice is as a parent. I've really enjoyed listening to your show and have been impressed with your ability to blend traditional medicine and alternative medicine in your practice. Can you speak on this issue? What do you recommend to parents? Thanks, Wendy. Well, thank you, Wendy, for a very politely phrased and intelligently phrased question. Let's start with a couple of premises. First of all, the Wakefield study was deeply flawed, and there is plenty of evidence that it cannot be generalized to the population. May not be, in fact, accurate to say that it's good science at all, but I don't want to get mired in that debate. But the bottom line is that if you start out and look at studies that are done with a random assignment of people to a group, and then you track them, you do not see increased risks of autism in the population. Now, that being said, if you have a brother or a sister with autism, then you probably want to look carefully at your DNA with respect to your detoxification enzymes. And that's a fairly straightforward functional medicine thing that can be done by a good FM practitioner down there in San Diego. But you're already where you're at with a one-year-old. So using a spread-out vaccine schedule is very intelligent. Why do I say that? Because if anyone in the family has an autoimmune disease like lupus or rheumatoid arthritis, I think there is credible data to say that you might flare this or stimulate the development of it even with the use of too many vaccines in the schedule that is recommended by the CDC. I've always looked at that schedule and said, all right, well, rotavirus. I don't think that I'm worried about this baby dying from rotavirus in San Diego with health insurance. What will happen is the baby will get diarrhea and will end up on an IV in a hospital. And yeah, that's a vaccine we can probably not give that child, unless, of course, grandma's on chemo and will die if she gets a severe diarrhea, in which case I'd probably vaccinate the child. Individualized approach. So, The reason that autoimmune diseases are stimulated by vaccines is because we're trying to stimulate the immune system with the vaccine. We're giving a dose of something, and we want the immune system to pay attention. We want it to say, ooh, what's that? 911, red alarm. We better make antibodies against that thing because I'm angry and excited by the way I feel when it's in my body. Yeah, that's exactly what we want. We want a defense reaction. The problem is if the immune system is already tweaked in the wrong direction and is hypersensitive and, in fact, attacking itself, well, then it's probably a bad idea to stimulate it. But that's not the situation with a typical healthy one-year-old. So spreading the vaccines out so that the adjuvant, which is this immune stimulation piece, which is a significant dose in any vaccines because these vaccines are tested separately. So if I want to prove that my vaccine works, I have to put enough immune stimulator in my vaccine so it'll work, so that I'll get antibodies, so that the FDA will say, you're right, your vaccine is good. It generates an antigenic response. Go you. Here's your approval. Go thou forth and market it. Well, yeah, and go you, because vaccines are awesome. They prevent disease. They allow us to have less severe versions of the disease. And, you know, this stuff 100 years ago used to kill kids right and left. That's why most families had five babies back in 1910. Was because they knew they were going to lose a couple to diphtheria and measles. Nobody loses anybody to diphtheria and measles anymore. Thank you very much. Thank you, vaccines. On the other hand, chickenpox, well, that almost never kills anybody. Why are we giving chickenpox vaccine? Well, to prevent the problems with zoster down the line. And shingles sucks. So, yeah, I get that, and I'm okay with it. But it's not a priority, and we need, I think, to prioritize our vaccines. So where do I put my priorities? Well, let's start with tetanus, pertussis, diphtheria, polio. Yeah, measles, mumps, rubella, very bad diseases. I think children should be vaccinated against them. I wouldn't want a woman to be walking around pregnant who was vulnerable to rubella. Can you imagine the heartbreak of giving birth to, can you imagine as a parent having your grandchild have heart disease or mental retardation because you decided in your ultimate wisdom not to vaccinate your daughter and she got pregnant and had the baby? You know, this stuff does go on at least to the second generation or the third, depending on how you count it. Things are crazy right now with all the fake news and the way the internet distorts and amplifies and creates an echo chamber. So you got to take a big, deep breath. And as is kind of being the theme of this program, go look at the science. And thank you, Wendy, for doing that, because that's clearly what you've done. So far as I'm concerned, spreading out the vaccines is what should be done for almost everybody, and it's probably enough. I do not think that there are any lethal vaccines. I think there are vulnerable individuals, and to the extent that we can identify them and shield them from vaccination or vaccinate them differently, we should do so. But we have a mass hysteria situation right now going on that will inevitably lead to epidemics and unnecessary deaths in the population, and we need to get a grip. Well, my regular listeners will be used to this, and I do like to range far and wide on this program, but I always try to keep it on a medical topic. It's fun to find out what enters under that very broad category, however. Things you wouldn't necessarily expect, like cybersecurity. Now, you may be thinking about that group of hackers that brought down the British medical system, but no, I'm actually talking about device cybersecurity. And this strikes a little closer to home, my friends. In August of 2017, the USDA issued a safety communication regarding the potential for malicious interference with battery life and programming of cardiac pacemakers. Pacemakers made by the St. Jude Medical Corporation, which unluckily for them was acquired by Abbott in 2017. There's about 450,000 people with these permanently implanted pacemakers. And the issue problem here is that software and remote monitoring have become embedded in these new, more modern systems. Not just pacemakers, but actually we're starting to see them in sleep apnea devices, diabetes management systems, and, well, we've got some problems with cybersecurity. Potential risks with the case of the pacemakers are, well, for one thing, adversarial parties could actually intentionally drain the battery of the affected device. They could use the home base stations to issue malicious programming commands and actually reprogram people's pacemakers. Now, there have been no reports of actual humans being injured. These are vulnerabilities that were described in a safety communication. And they announced that there would be a downloadable software patch that would be automatically applied to the patient's home monitors as soon as it was written. Well, we all know about software patches. This one was going to work as long as the base station was plugged in and connected. And so they developed a firmware upgrade and included all the new device implants. From there forward, there's not a cybersecurity issue. This upgrade was pretty good. It layered in levels of security for radio frequency telemetry attacks and defenses against using the base station to send commands to the implanted devices. That's good because some of these are pacemaker defibrillators, which means that someone could remotely defibrillate your heart. Not a good way to start your morning. Now, there's a few problems with this. And in the process of applying the patch, there's going to be a really, really small chance of throwing the person into cardiac arrest or fibrillation. That's very, very unlikely, 0.003%, although how they can actually calculate that, I'm not sure. But the problem is when you multiply 0.003 by 450,000, you get a number that's bigger than zero, way bigger than zero. In fact, more than 200 patients could potentially encounter this risk. Well, that's fine, right? You can go into your doctor's office and have your pacemaker software upgraded. And indeed, you can. The problem is that doctor had better be ready to deal with a code, which means access to full emergency pacing. And that's not something that most of us, primary care doctors, or for that matter, most cardiologists, don't have external pacers in their office that they can just slap onto a patient. That's really a hospital device. Currently, we don't even know whether pacemakers made by other companies might have the same vulnerabilities. All that remote monitoring of the device, well, it's not just a one-way thing, is it? Really, what needs to happen is that there needs to be a partnership between the FDA and industry to create corrective actions, test and allow for quantification of the actual event rate so we know whether this is a problem. Going forward, we need to test these devices for vulnerability before they're released. Now, the first time this happens, of course, you're not going to know, but now we do know. And as we go forward with particularly diabetes and sleep apnea come to mind as areas where vulnerability to reprogramming from a malicious remote source, or for that matter, just being confused by some sort of Trojan that got in there that really wasn't trying to, but disrupted the device. These are things that we're going to need to insist that we be protected from, because in 2018, these are very real issues. My next story involves another unexpected topic for healthcare, mouthwash. A researcher from the Harvard School of Public Health, Kalmundi Joshipura, did a study looking at the use of mouthwash and found some rather surprising statistics. This study looked at overweight individuals aged 40 to 65 who did not have diabetes or heart disease. They asked them how often they used mouthwash, and of the many participants, 43% used it at least once daily and 22% at least twice daily. Those using mouthwash more than twice daily or more had a significantly elevated risk of diabetes over the three-year follow-up of the study compared to controls. In fact, if you compare to non-users of mouthwash, twice or more daily users had a risk of as much as 1.5 times, 150% of developing diabetes. So that's 55% more, pretty substantial. Now, they controlled for income, education, oral hygiene, presence of other oral conditions, sleep apnea, diet, medications, just about everything you can imagine to make sure that these people fell into two distinct groups. And for those of you who only use it once daily, you'll be relieved to know that there was no increased risk associated with once daily use. Of course, it was only a three-year study. What's going on here? Well, the researchers postulate that it has to do with nitric oxide, which is produced by bacteria in the mouth. And of course, these ingredients, such as chlorhexidine and triclosan that are in modern mouthwashes, are toxic to bacteria. And so they're wondering if that could, by wiping out the friendly bacteria that produce nitric oxide, interfere with insulin regulation. Yeah, it's getting frightening to discover how we are such a house of cards or a chain of dominoes when it compares to all of this auto-regulation stuff, which is influenced by bacteria living in and on us. I guess when John Donne said no man was an island, he wasn't kidding. I don't know about you, but I'm a sucker for happy endings. And when it comes to breast cancer, any ending of those breast cancer cells is a happy one. I'm also a sucker for when breast cancer or other cancer research turns up new use for an old drug that's already been FDA approved. We know the risks, we know the benefits, and we know how to dose it. And to boot, it's cheap and generic. Now, that always feels good in this age of blatant exploitation of people by the pharmaceutical companies. This story is about methionine, an amino acid, one of the essential amino acids. Remember those from high school science? Well, we've known since the 1980s that many cancer cells are sensitive to the deprivation of this essential amino acid, methionine. And the reason that this occurs is kind of interesting. Cancer cells rewire themselves to grow rapidly. And there's a particular gene called PIK3CA that changes the way amino acids are handled. And it rewires the metabolic pathway to fuel the needs of these more rapidly dividing cells. And we're really trying to figure out if there's a back door to that metabolic upregulation, a vulnerability that comes along with making these changes. And we seem to have found one here. In reviewing the literature, these researchers found that dependency in cancer cells was often correlated with low levels of activity of another gene, of another enzyme called XCT. And I won't bore you with the deep biochemistry, but what the researchers did was they took these methionine-sensitive cells and found other tumors that were not methionine sensitive, and they looked at their growth rates after they took the ones that were not methionine sensitive and gave them a drug called sulfasalazine. This is a sulfadine, and it's been around for a very long time. It's used to treat rheumatoid arthritis, ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, and it's taken by mouth. Now, if you could take something like that to inhibit the growth of a breast cancer, this could be a really big deal. Well, when hit with sulfasalazine, the breast cancer cells that would ordinarily have been able to survive in a methionine-starved environment were no longer able to do so. So maybe we can trigger methionine dependency using sulfasalazine, and it will be not too long before someone starts testing out that idea. In another example of better living through biochemistry, researchers in Germany have developed a diagnostic chewing gum for people with dental implants that have become infected or inflamed. Turns out this is not particularly rare. 6 to 15% of patients with dental implants will develop an inflammatory response in the years after receiving a dental implant. In the worst case scenario, this is caused by bacteria actually destroying the soft tissue in the bone around the implant. Can't sterilize the mouth. The test is rather interesting. With there is inflammation in the oral cavity, there are enzymes that degrade proteins that are activated in the mouth. So if you put this special piece of chewing gum in your mouth and chew on it for about 5 minutes, these enzymes will start to break down a special secret ingredient in the gum, which is a bittering agent. So the gum will start to taste bitter. And if you taste the bitter, well, that means that you're breaking down the chemical, and therefore you have these enzymes, which means you have these bacteria. So a very good diagnostic test that can be done remotely. And it turns out this is a growth industry. There are lots of labs working on chewing gum diagnoses to exploit the fact that the bacteria in our mouth actually behave a little differently when there's inflammation. And also, the bacteria have, as we've just discussed, other properties related to the diabetes story I covered earlier this program. Now, I'm going to anticipate a question that someone might have called in with, and that's, well, what about probiotics specially designed for your teeth? And indeed, I have seen such commercially available probiotics. I actually bought some from my dentist, but I have to acknowledge I wasn't very good about taking them. Yes, I'll cop to it. The idea, however, seems sound, and I'm waiting to see some long-term research that maybe will persuade me to take another stab at it if I know that the product actually works to help protect my teeth. And, you know, when you protect your teeth, you protect your brain. I might be a little bit more motivated to figure out a way to be more regular about my use. This next story may be one of the top unreported events in science of 2017, but I think it could have a huge impact on the treatment and research in Lyme disease. It may go a long way forward to convincing physicians that indeed Lyme disease can hang around in the body long after it's left the bloodstream, and also convince them that even with appropriate treatment, this disease can persist. This research was done in macaque monkeys. You want to look at PLOS 1, 2017, 1212, and the author to look for is Monica Embers, E-M-B-E-R-S. Before I describe the findings, I just want to tell you how they set up the study. So they had ticks carrying Lyme disease feed on 10 primates. 4 months post-infection, five of the primates received the antibiotic doxycycline orally for about 28 days at a dose proportional to that used in human treatment. Now, it's important that this was 4 months post-infection. Five subjects were treated with placebo, and all 10 were then evaluated by more than five different diagnostic methods to characterize any remaining infection. Among other things, the findings demonstrated that all of the subjects that were treated with antibiotics were found to have some level of infection 7 to 12 months post-treatment. Even more importantly, despite testing negative by antibody tests for Lyme disease, 2 of the 10 subjects were still infected with Lyme bacteria in the heart and the bladder. And the Lyme bacteria that they had were still viable and therefore could be used to infect others. Intact spirochetes were found in 3 of the 5 treated and 4 of the 5 untreated subjects based on xenodiagnosis results 12 months after the tick bite. Rhesus macaque monkeys are known to have very similar patterns of infections to humans. And one of the findings of this study that may also apply to humans, certainly seems like it to me from the clinical variability that we see, is that the immune responses to Lyme disease varied greatly post-treatment, with one subject's antibody levels dropping to near pre-bite levels for 3 antigens, while another subject experienced elevated antibodies for the same antigens throughout the study period. This is really important because it demonstrates that people infected with the same strain of Burgdorferi might have different immune responses and therefore different antibody testings. It underscores that testing antibody responses may be inherently unreliable as a singular diagnostic modality for this really important disease. Another important finding was that there was widespread and variable microscopic disease in all the infected subjects, despite antibiotic treatment. Compared to uninfected subjects of the same age, the infected subjects had more inflammation in the heart, skeletal muscles, joints, and the meninges, the protective sheath that covers the brain. Even scarier is in 2 subjects that were treated with doxycycline, multiple Lyme bacteria were found in the brain tissue itself. They also found the spirochetes in the heart, joints, bladder, skeletal muscle, and adjacent to the peripheral nerves. This is a fundamental shock to the system that the antibody tests were negative, and yet live spirochetes were found in these many tissues. I'll leave you with a quote from Wendy Adams, Research Grant Director, Bay Area Lyme Foundation. "Clearly, some medical practices governing diagnosis and treatment of Lyme disease should be reconsidered in light of this study. This study shows that we must reevaluate the current paradigm of antibody response tests for diagnosis and move away from the one-size-fits-all approach to Lyme treatment. Every day, patients with Lyme disease are told their symptoms cannot be caused by Lyme because they test negative on antibody tests or because they have received a single dose of antibiotics. More research and funding are imperative." Well, I can't say it better than that. I also want to point out that this is a small study, that they only had 10 experimental animals. It needs to be replicated in other labs. But if it does, in fact, replicate, we need to drastically rethink our diagnosis and management of Lyme disease, particularly in Lyme endemic areas, because we may be missing a great deal. And the people who I've always kind of rolled my eyes at, who see Lyme under every tree and behind every bush, well, they may have a point. Stay tuned. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.